You know where you are. You are at Beyond the Matrix, and you're here because you do dare to think outside the box of convention, which is what this show is all about. In fact, it's what my life is all about. So thank you for being with me, Patricia Corey. You know I'm into the Syrian vibration and the exciting, I'm just really thrilled to be able to bring you the author of The Serious Mystery, which was a life-altering book for me. And, of course, we're going to be talking about his new book tonight, but I will ask him a few questions about that since I have this great opportunity to be speaking with him and his lovely wife, Olivia, who is the co-author of this book for the Sphinx Mystery. You know, I don't think this man needs an introduction. He's the author of many challenging books. That's why he's here, because no matter what when we have fixed ideas about any reality, Beyond the Matrix wants to check our buttons and make sure that we haven't locked ourselves into the mind matrix. So he's going to challenge me a little bit with his theories of this new book tonight. But I am always excited to learn new things, and that's what the show is about, as I said. So without any further ado, I should say just a little bit more about him. This man, his books have been translated into 44 foreign languages. He's a visiting professor of the history and philosophy of science at Tsinghua University in Beijing, and he's also held a similar position in a United States university. He's a writer par excellence. He's got videos and TV shows, and he's just the man. And Olivia said she brings a lot of color to the story. So without any further ado, are you there, Robert and Olivia?
Hello, we're here and we're blushing.
Hello there.
Hello. I love your English accent, you know?
Hello, how are you? Would you like to come to tea one day?
Oh, well, I sure would. Don't say that too loud, because I'm often in England and you might find me on your doorstep.
I'd be delighted.
I wondered what that bundle was outside.
Well, thank you both. It's really, as I said, a great pleasure to finally hear your voice and to be able to pick your brain, I guess. And, you know, this book, gang, is something else. I mean, it is just, poof! The first exciting thing about the book is, I don't know how you managed to get your hands on such incredible photos without even discussing the knowledge and the history and the research. The photos themselves in this book, many of them are from the 1800s and revealing aspects of Egypt, my beloved Egypt, that really cut the doubt away, don't they?
We've collected vintage photographs of ancient Egyptian landmarks, and we have now quite a big archive. Some of them are black and white postcards. Some of them are personal photographs from people's albums. Some of them are the ones where you hold up the thing and what do you call them, stereoscopes, where it looks like two pictures until you look through a funny little spectacle thing and it becomes one, so it's three-dimensional.
Oh, yes, the merging.
And then we have obviously taken a good many ourselves over the years, and we have a lot of early engravings. So it's, in fact, most of them can be seen on the website, which is www.sphinxmystery.info. And they can be seen in color there, which they cannot be seen in color in the book because it's all in duotone. And I would recommend looking at the website because they look so much better.
Okay, that's good because these pictures are very important photos. Are they all on the website?
Yes.
Great.
So do
you run that by again?
The color ones that are on the website. The vintage ones are not. They can just be seen in the book, but the ones that you need to be able to see in full color, the ones we took, are on the website.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to say this might sound diminutive, but for just the photos alone, people need to get this magnificent book, The Sphinx Mystery, by Robert and Olivia Temple, published by Inner Tradition. So we're going to get into the book now, and, geez, I don't even know where to jump into this book. Basically, of course, there are a few very central themes. Would you, Robert, would you like to give us an overview of, what got you on this track and what the basic theme in the book is?
Well, every paragraph of the book is way beyond any matrix.
That's for sure.
There's nothing in the book that anybody's ever read before. And it is most certainly not a retread of old theories, orthodox or otherwise. And we took 10 years to write this book, but...
I can imagine.
It goes back to when Olivia and I first went to Egypt, and we went to see the Sphinx with great eagerness, and we stood there looking at the Sphinx, and we thought, what's wrong? It's just all wrong. Something is terribly, terribly wrong here. And we realized that it's this gigantic stone statue, which really is about the size of an ocean liner, and on the front of it is this little pimple of a head. Now, when you see
photos...
Right,
the head is so disproportionate.
Yeah, when you see photos from the front, you don't know that because you're only seeing the face, and the face is very impressive,
mm-hmm.
and you don't realize it's totally out of proportion with the body, and it's just not right because who were the most fanatical people in the history of the world about getting proportion right in statues? The Egyptians.
Exactly.
They would never have done this. So it was immediately obvious to us that the head had been recarved and cut down. And at that time, we had no idea what that might have meant, but it was instantly obvious to us. And a lot of people have commented on this. We're not the only ones. But
I was going to say, this is kind of level one of Beyond the Matrix, but your thesis is like level 10 Beyond the Matrix.
Well,
so level one Beyond the Matrix is that the head doesn't fit, and the story that this is the pharaoh is difficult to believe when you look at those proportions, as you said.
That's
right. I just wanted to reject that before you get to the killer theory going to be talking about.
We'd always been told at school, because we're good little boys and girls, aren't we? And we believe what teacher tells
mm-hmm.
us, and we believe in all that herd thinking that everybody indulges in.
Not on Beyond the Matrix.
I was really teasing. So, we'd been told that the Sphinx had the body of a lion. Everybody, quote, knows, unquote, that the Sphinx has the body of a lion. It's what everybody
knows.
Yeah,
it does really feel that way to me as well. That's why I'm, open to hear.
We looked at the Sphinx and we thought, where's the lion? There's no lion there. And we then began to doubt ourselves for a moment, and we thought, maybe we lack some ability which other people have, which is the ability to see lions, that we were somehow lion dyslexic. And then we realized that it couldn't be a lion. It never had been a lion, and it simply wasn't a lion because there was nothing lion-like about it in any way. And lions, and we have many illustrations of ancient Egyptian lions starting from the first dynasty in the book to prove this, were always portrayed by the Egyptians in a canonical fashion with a great rising chest and a mane and very macho-looking creatures. They were the royal symbol of the king. And this was a statue of an animal with a flat back. It did not rise in the front. There was no big chest. There was no mane. Nothing remotely like a lion.
And the lion has a...
Well, but you're talking about a male lion. What about the female?
Well, females don't look like this either.
There's not... Well, there's a bit of difference. There's only... The male has the mane, right? And the lioness doesn't?
Well, it has the mane, and it has a much more powerful musculature, like Robert is saying, in the front.
Yeah.
I've actually never seen an actual statue of a female lion in Egypt, although a female lion's head... It seems to be used to portray the goddess Sekhmet. But that's,
that's
another subject we better not get straying into. But
well,
what it looked like to us,
if we have time.
what it looked like to us was a dog. And this isn't just because we're passionate dog lovers, but because I've always been interested in Anubis, as you know, since the Sirius mystery. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me a perfect example of a giant statue of Anubis crouching there at the entrance to the necropolis as a guard dog. The only thing was the head had been chopped off and recarved. And we then later did the research and discovered that there was a huge amount of evidence to substantiate the idea that the Sphinx was originally a giant Anubis.
And what kind of evidence is there?
Well,
what do you bring forward in the book?
There's a lot of textual evidence from the pyramid texts. See, Egyptologists always are moaning and whinging and complaining about the fact that they've got the largest statue in the world and it's never mentioned in the ancient texts. But if you're thinking that it's Anubis, it's all over the place. The pyramid texts and the coffin texts are full of references to a giant Anubis, not only at Giza, but at Rostow, which is the portion of Giza which is in the Sphinx precinct area. And it, twice it's even described as being beside a causeway. And other features, which I'll come to later when we talk about the Sphinx pit and the erosion. And so
Anubis was described as the guardian of the necropolis and guarding the underworld, the entrance to the underworld.
So he's mentioned constantly in the ancient texts as being at Giza beside a causeway and guarding the necropolis. And that's exactly what the Sphinx is doing. So that pretty well convinced us that we were right, that the Sphinx had originally been Anubis and that it is a dog's body, and originally it had a dog's head. Now, when would that head have been ruined? We suspect that it was at the end of the Old Kingdom period, when there was a period of turmoil, which the Egyptologists call by the extremely mild name of the First Intermediate Period. In fact, it was not as calm as the name suggests, because it was a period of complete chaos and lawlessness, during which time the whole civilization of Egypt collapsed, and there was no law and order, there was not really a proper ruler, and mobs are known to have rampaged around Giza at that time, smashing things.
Especially statues.
Yeah, they smashed all the statues of Khafre, and all the Egyptologists know and accept that fact. So it makes sense that if there had been a giant Anubis sitting there with pointy ears and pointy nose, that the same mobs who smashed all the statues would have had a go and knocked off the ears and the nose and reduced the head of Anubis to a kind of stump, which is what we believe it was until it was recarved. And I then was able to figure out who recarved it and when. Now, it wasn't just a matter of recarving a dog's face, because we believe the dog's face had already been mutilated to the point where it could never be reconstructed. So, to cut a long story short, I was able to demonstrate, and this is pretty conclusively proved in the book, that the recarving was done by the third pharaoh of the 12th dynasty, a period known as the Middle Kingdom, whose name was Amenemhat II. And
the photo that you show really is the closest image I've ever seen to the image that's on the that now serves as the head of the Sphinx.
I'm glad you think
much
so.
Much more than the theory that this was a black African. We've heard that African female. I'm sure you've heard that theory as well.
Well, the face of Amenemhat II is identical to the face on the Sphinx, and we show photographs of both in the book, as you just pointed out.
And it also does have a slightly Mona Lisa-like enigmatic smile, and could could be a woman, really.
Yeah? Well, maybe.
Well, every time we see icons of spirituality, we've got that enigmatic face, like the Buddha.
Mm.
Akhenaten. And there is that question, that amorphous sexuality. And I just can't help but think that it has been represented through time as the synthetization of that male-female duality.
Mm. Well, that's a possibility. It strikes me as being asexual, really.
I was able to find an old Victorian article by a very famous German Egyptologist called Ludwig Burckhardt, in which he analyzed the head and face of the Sphinx at a time when it was still unexcavated, so that he was sort of able to stand more or less at its same height and stare it in the face. And he could see the headcloth very clearly. And he was able to prove that only in the 12th dynasty were those particular stripe patterns used by surveying all the other known statues in existence in museums. But this article was dismissed after the Sphinx was fully excavated in 1926 and 1936, because then it was obvious that the Sphinx itself was much earlier than the 12th dynasty, so everybody just laughed at Burckhardt and said, ha, 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 he was, you know, going off his head at the time, and he wrote this silly article. But they overlooked the fact that he wasn't analyzing the Sphinx, he was analyzing the Sphinx's head only. Mm. And his analysis was absolutely correct, and I have translated with the most difficulty you can possibly imagine, because his old-fashioned German was so difficult. The entire text of his article, and it's an appendix in the book so that everybody can read it in English, his incredibly minute and brilliant analysis of the stripes and patterns on the head of the Sphinx, which prove absolutely conclusively that it has to be 12th dynasty.
But before that, when it was a new...
You mean the carving of the head, not the whole structure?
Yeah,
the head only. The head only.
Because as you probably know of... Hakim, who Barbara Hand Clow is your publisher, right?
In a tradition.
Yeah. Isn't she connected to Inner Traditions?
We don't know her.
No.
No.
Barbara Hand Clow?
No, I don't know her. Do you, Robert?
No, afraid not.
Oh, that's bizarre. She's one of the co-owners, I think, of Inner Traditions.
Oh, well,
and she's worked a lot with a man named Hakim, who you must have heard of.
I don't know. Have you heard of him?
Well, I know a patent agent called Joe Hakim.
No, Hakim was, unfortunately, he's just passed away, and he lived at Giza all of his life for who knows how many generations. And he is a... he tells the oral tradition of the Kemetians, and according to him, the Sphinx is 50,000 years old. What do you say to that?
Well, he's going back a bit. We thought we were going back far enough, but that is really a stellar amount of time. He may be right. I mean, he may have been picking up sort of psychic.
I'm afraid he's not right. That head is unquestionably 12th dynasty.
Right? Yeah, but he might.
I'm talking not just about
the
carving of the head. I'm talking about the entire
the
structure.
Actual creature.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, you never know how far this goes back, but you know,
it definitely looks older than the date that you're ascribing to the carving of the head.
Yeah.
And that makes sense because
the head
would have had
to
be taken away first.
The head is younger than the body. The head is younger than the body.
Exactly.
It's recarved out of the neck of the original head.
The neck would have just been a stump, and this fellow, the pharaoh, put his own face on it, just like somebody would if they were a pharaoh and there was a face for a face.
Much, much more interesting than all this is the question of the secret chamber.
Yeah.
Yes, I was just going
to
ask you to get to that.
I just want to give you one little insight into in one of the coffin texts. For instance, which are Middle Kingdom, they have these wonderful things called spells, which are meant to be read by the deceased because they're on the lids of the coffins on the inside. One of them refers to the fact that the deceased has entered into its gate. This is the netherworld, the gate of the netherworld, which is under the care of Anubis.
Well, Anubis was guarding not just the Giza necropolis, but the gates to the underworld, which are at Rostow, which is his particular part of the foothills of Giza, which is where those
can
two
you,
temples
before
are.
You go to the chamber, can you talk, I've talked to Christopher Dunn, who's an author that you may know, and he told me I've got to get to Rostow and see Abu Ruwash.
Oh, yes.
Are you familiar with that location?
Yes.
Abu Wash is absolutely fascinating, and in fact, I describe it at great length in my next book, Egyptian Dawn, which is going to be going to the printer in the summer.
What does he think?
Wow.
Chris Dunn? about it?
Well, he's talking about having discovered sluice marks or cut marks in the stone somewhere to the south of the site. And you know, he's if you've read his work, you know that he's about that aspect of the whole story, the technology of the whole story in the Giza power
plant. Have you seen those marks on the slabs that are near Abu Roash?
Well, I see that you talk about Abu Roash in your book, so I'd like to have some, before we skip over to the very exciting part of the underground tunnel, if you could just give some insights into what you think that site, Abu Roash, represents.
Well, I'm convinced it never was a pyramid. Mm. That's a fantasy. For one thing, the huge excavations in the bedrock there are so enormous that no pyramid could possibly have been sustained on top of it. It would have fallen in. And people very foolishly claimed that these were a passage and a chamber of what either was a pyramid or was intended to be a pyramid, but I'm convinced they're wrong. Now, we know from the illustration of the surrounding wall published in 1837 by Howard Weiss that there was a giant stone wall, at least 12 courses of stonework high, surrounding this great chasm in the earth on top of this hill. And there was certainly this structure that surrounded it, but I believe it had a completely different purpose. It was never intended to be, and certainly never was, a pyramid, as often suggested. And I believe, because it's oriented precisely north-south, that it was an astronomical observation shaft for observing the culminations of stars at the meridian in order to be able to get a correct calendar. Because the Egyptians were absolutely obsessed with time and especially the calendar. They knew the length of the year, which is 365.2624 days, to that degree of accuracy, although they didn't use decimal points, they used fractions, but they knew the exact length of the year. And I believe they were only able to know it by using the great shaft at Abu Roash and the other one that's just like it at a much lower altitude, the other side of the pyramids, at a place called Zawiyat El Aryan, which nobody can get access to because it's in a military base.
Now, what is a military base doing over there, you ask yourself?
Well, they've got an awful lot of militia in Egypt, and they haven't got much to do.
You know, these pyramids at Dahshur 20 years ago or so were also in a military base, and that was closed down, that base, so that we can now go see the Bent Pyramid and the Red Pyramid.
But, and so is the Step Pyramid. It's right. If you go to the Step Pyramid at Saqqara, you can see the military all around you.
Yes, well, the Egyptians have a huge army, and they've got to put them somewhere.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they've got so many people to spare when you want to go to an area that they're worried about for security reasons, and you end up with an armed convoy, which we've done several times.
It's terribly funny.
And so have I.
Have you? It's amazing, isn't it? You get rather used to it. But we were escorted to one point where they had to then leave us to be taken over by another contingent from another area that we'd moved into, and we were just left at the side of the road. So there was hardly any point in taking us there in a convoy because we were dumped, really, until the next one came along and rescued us. Mind you, we did not feel remotely threatened. They're such, on the whole, such sweet people, and the Egyptians, and we've never felt threatened.
I agree, and I think a lot of it is pomp and circumstance, but I really don't want military in my pyramids.
I know.
It's quite unnerving when you're examining a site in Middle Egypt somewhere, which is the part of Egypt where they worry about the fundamentalists, to have 30 men with machine guns standing around you in a semicircle with their backs to you, pointing outwards in case you're attacked to protect you.
Well, they're protecting their tourist industry, really, and so they should. Anyway,
but I've been in pyramids where they've got machine sites like Abydos, where guards have come in with machine guns, and I've asked them to put down the machine guns.
Have they? We've been to Abydos a lot. We haven't had that happen. But
have you been there lately?
Not lately, not in the last year or two.
Well, the sad news is they're tearing up and they're digging between the city temple, city one, and Ramses temples, and they're going to change it so much. So, I recommend people to get there as soon as they can because God only knows what they're going to do, and of course, God only knows what they're going to find because we know
there's got to be
a lot of wealth under there.
So they're looking for archaeological things, you mean?
But I think they're looking for wealth as well, because if you consider, this was considered the great temple or the great graveyard of Osiris, it would be understandable that all of the nobility would want to be buried there.
How close?
I think that it's going to be blowing us away, what's really under there, just as much as Giza Plateau.
How close to the Temple of Seti the First is all this?
Very close. In other words, the last time I was there, which was months ago, they had tractors there in that tranquil, idyllic setting, and all this sand and dust was blowing into the temple. I couldn't even go in the morning.
Really?
Yeah.
Good Lord, well, we didn't know that. That sounds very alarming, because that is such...
And they're also working down in the Osirian, which
in
is more alarming. Yeah.
Really?
What are they doing down there?
Have they drained it?
Well, you remember the rushes that are probably thousands of years old?
Yes, I love those rushes.
They're gone.
They're gone?
They're gone.
So they're draining that water and looking... Under
they're draining it. They've taken away the rushes, which is just heresy. There's I don't know what they're doing, but I think they're looking for treasure. More than archaeology.
I'm trying to find out how close to the actual temple the bulldozers are.
I couldn't give you an exact measurement, but I can tell you that it's to the right of the Seti temple. And for those of you who are listening who don't know this, bear with us because this is kind of big news. As you're looking at the temple, it's to the right of the temple. You know where the Ramses temple is?
Yeah. But how close to the Seti temple? Like... The distance of a bus or the distance of 10 buses? Or
I would say a distance of a bus max.
So almost right next to it?
Yes, almost right next to it. It's horrible. And when you go there, you've got these machines digging. It's very upsetting. But even more upsetting was to see the Osirian broken. And from an energy point of view, which is how I work, the energy was just broken.
Oh, my God.
So I'm going to go back in November and see what's happening. But there's a lot going on there because there are countless tombs there.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Well, that sounds very depressing because it's been left alone for a long time. And
I know. It's been the best-kept secret in town, as they say.
But they still take tourists there, and you can get there quite easily.
Well, yeah, there's no longer the requirement for the convoy.
Oh, isn't there?
No. But the good thing is that, you know, of course, I always tell people, what better way than to get a bunch of tourists shot at than to spread them all together racing through Egypt on a convoy?
Yes,
but
exactly.
Now they've got many more roadblocks. But you don't no longer have to be with the military convoy.
No. Well, anyway, that was part of... They're doing their
anyway, we've
thing.
Gotten off the track. I'm sorry,
yeah,
we want to get back to the discussion of what... So you were talking about that site of Abu Rush being an astronomical observation point.
Yes. What they were concerned with in order to tell the time precisely... was exactly what time a star crossed the meridian, which is the north-south line, which they looked at up the shaft. And they had very precise timekeeping by water clocks and so on. And so by this means of meticulous observation every night, every year, for centuries and centuries, they were able to refine their observations and get a precise duration of the year. And they were able to discover aspects of the motions of the planets and the stars and the Earth and whatever that were incredibly highly advanced, more so than anything until modern times.
And when would you, do you have research that proves this theory in the book?
Yes, I'm writing about it at the moment.
Not in the
book. Oh, right, you're writing about it in the new book. Can you tell us the title again of the new book?
Egyptian Dawn.
Egyptian Dawn. Well, we'll be looking for that one, even though this one is going to take a lot of people a lot of time to get through, because it is really just an enormous book. Enormous. In fact, I'm only just beginning.
A previous book called The Crystal Sun, which...
I have that one. I haven't read it yet.
Well, it proves that the Egyptians had rudimentary telescopes. I have photographs of ancient crystal lenses from Egypt and so on. And the whole book is about
amazing.
Ancient optical technology.
And I've always had a theory that the ancients used lenses to even potentially burn through a lot of matter.
Yes, they used them as burning lenses, absolutely.
Fantastic. I can't wait to get to that one.
Well, it won't be for another year or so, I shouldn't think.
No, the Crystal Sun.
I've got it here parked, but I've got so much to do myself. I've got my own books coming out and reading for the show, and my library is building up. But someday I will be able to sit down and just take a month off and read.
That's what we have to do, really. We've got the same situation. We just don't have enough time to read. You need to switch off and get somewhere else where you're not near a phone or the internet.
Oh, yes, that would be blessed.
Shall I tell you about the secret chamber now?
Yeah, that was my question. Let's get into, you were beginning to talk about Rasta, which we know means the city of tunnels. And I'm very curious about your experiences, and I've got my own, but I looked into that. You call it the picture of you coming out of the ass of the Sphinx, which is too adorable.
It's really a bit much, that one. I took that photo, of course.
She always takes photos of me in compromising conditions.
I told him to call back in
Sorry
and come
about
out
that.
Again. So I could get a better shot.
Well, but will you go ahead and then just take us on this journey through... into the ever-thought quest to get into the secret chamber of the Sphinx. Please give us your knowledge and wisdom and experience.
Most people who are interested in the Sphinx know that there is a little tunnel at the back, what we call the rump tunnel, and it leads to a scooped-out hollow in the bedrock about 19 feet down, which is only big enough for a couple of people to stand in, and it's very crudely carved, clearly not original, but was used in ancient times, probably for the purpose of incubation, that is, to sleep there overnight and have a sacred dream during the Greek and Roman periods, maybe earlier. But the secret chamber that I'm referring to is not that one. It's often been suggested, and of course this was very strongly suggested by Edgar Cayce, the psychic,
right,
that there is a secret chamber under the Sphinx. And nobody's ever really come up with actual conclusive evidence of one. It's always been just a suggestion. But I was able to find the proof, which was very useful. And... this was not easy, but I've been able to...
What is the proof? I would think it wasn't easy at all, and dying to know what the proof is.
Well, I was able to piece together over the years 281 years worth of published eyewitness accounts from early books of people who actually entered a chamber beneath the Sphinx, which was a burial chamber, which even had the remains of a coffin in it. I mean, the burial chamber had been robbed in ancient times, but there was still traces of a coffin in there, and they described the chamber as being covered in hieroglyphics. So if we could ever get back in there, we could read what the texts say, and we could find out what was going on. Now, this was all sealed up in 1926, finally, by a Frenchman called Emile Barrès, who was asked to try to tidy up the things for tourist purposes. And his way of doing that was to smear cement over everything and pour concrete down holes and tunnels and block up all the chambers.
Oh.
And there are other chambers in the Sphinx, and I've crawled along. There is a tunnel inside the Sphinx that goes from the rump towards the waist. And the end of it, we don't know how far it went, because the end of it now is Barrès's concrete where he blocked it. It may have gone the whole length of the Sphinx for all we know.
You were in the rump and you saw this tunnel?
Absolutely. There's a photograph of it in the book. And a photograph of the rump tunnel as well, of course. And the burial chamber was beneath the waist of the Sphinx, that is, the haunches. And we know precisely where it was, because it was all measured very carefully in early days, and the number of feet it was from the back of the neck and the number of feet from the back of the rump and the exact position and the size of the rectangular opening of the vertical shaft, which led from the top of the Sphinx straight down through the haunches into this chamber carved out of the bedrock beneath the Sphinx, which was a burial chamber where somebody was buried in. It must have been a king, because nobody else would be able to get away with that. And this is what Pliny said.
Well, how do we know? I mean, there is a lot of theory that contradicts the idea that the sarcophagi were actually used for burial, always used for burial. And how do we know for sure that this was a burial chamber? Was it a sarcophagus?
It had the remains of a wooden coffin. It's not just a stone coffer like in the Great Pyramid, which I agree was never used for burial. In other words, I'm convinced the Great Pyramid was never intended as a tomb. It may have been.
Oh, that's good to hear. So we are definitely in harmony on that.
Oh, yes. It was probably intended as a sacred, symbolic, empty tomb, but it was never used for burial, I'm certain.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And, of course, Christopher Dunn claims that the... Because I've been down under... Have you been inside the Osiris shaft?
I have indeed. In fact, I've got a very detailed account of it in Egyptian Dawn, complete with photos.
Have you been?
Yes, I have.
Really?
Yes, I did. I don't know how I managed.
That was really brave of you with that ladder.
Oh, God. It was the bravest thing I've ever done in my life. Ask me if I'll do it again. No.
It's not a very safe ladder, is it?
Did you go all the way
around? Especially, I'm not the lightest woman in town. And I was thinking to myself, you know, one slip of the foot, well, there are worse ways to go than being buried under the Giza Plateau.
Well, I was halfway up the ladder when the lights went out, and I was plunged into the pitch dark, and the handles of the ladder were covered in moisture, and I was slipping. And the ladder kept sliding back and forth, and I thought I'd had it.
It was a very frightening experience. What did you... I'm sorry that we're off the track again, but this is just such a celebration talking to you. What is your experience of that claim? What is claimed to be a sarcophagus at the bottom of that 33-meter drop down from the plateau surface to the inner grounds?
Yeah, it's about, I think it's 183 feet below the surface or something when you get down to the bottom. Well, it's unquestionably a replica of the tomb of Osiris, because it has that canal around it filled with water, and the granite sarcophagus, and it was probably always empty, but it was the same as the island of the Osirian, which was another symbolic tomb of Osiris, which was underground.
Yes, in fact, I've made that correlation in my book, which is coming out soon, Where Pharaohs Dwell. But I can't help but wonder if that the same element would be interestingly functional as some kind of a battery system or an energy storage system. You've got the water, you've got the granite. Conduction, no?
Well, no, I see what you mean. Yeah, the bedrock is, of course, limestone, but the sarcophagus is definitely granite, as you say, yes.
thought to myself, yeah, this is really looking like some sort of elaborate, gigantic battery network, but then I'm not technically knowledgeable, so I just left it there. But I had too many things to think about when I was down there, like survival.
Did you go with somebody? Presumably you
No, well, I had, a, let's say, a private person that was overseeing me, but he let me go ahead, and I went down pretty deep by myself. Very heavy experience.
Very heavy, and then you've got to come back up, which doesn't help.
That's the shocker.
We've actually
Sorry, you were still talking about the real chamber that you now have proof exists.
Well, yes, all of the accounts of the Sphinx published from the time of Pliny in the 1st century AD, the Roman author, up until 1837 are gathered in the back of the Sphinx Mystery, and most of them were not in English, and we've translated them all. Olivia translated all the French ones, and I did the German ones, and there's even a Dutch one. And it's all there, the entire history, published history of descriptions of the Sphinx in our book. You don't have to go to the international libraries and spend all the years finding that stuff like I did, because it's all gathered there. So just as you pointed out that it's a great collection of photographs, you have a complete collection of all the descriptions of the Sphinx over the course of nearly 2,000 years, all gathered in the back of the book.
It's a wealth of information. It's remarkable, just like the Sirius Mystery was. But this one, you can see that there are 10 years of effort here, because it's utterly amazing. I mean, I'm really embarrassed to tell you that I've only just kind of gotten into the first quarter of it, and my mind
just
is blown, I admit it.
We're trying to just unlock a door with another key, and we're not really theorizing. We're just putting stuff out there for people to see what they make of it, and we feel we've done a bit.
In fact, you've been very generous with that, and in providing sources of information and sort of making a compendium of knowledge out of this work.
We didn't want to put forward a theory of a secret chamber beneath the Sphinx. We wanted to find the evidence, and so we've put the evidence in print so that everybody can read it for themselves. And I don't think there's any way anybody can deny that 281 years worth of published eyewitness accounts of people who actually entered the chamber must be true, and it must exist.
And in these accounts, do you show or recount any of the experiences people have had in this chamber?
Well, it tended to fill up with sand a lot, and so a lot of the people couldn't see terribly well, and there were some people who cleared it away. The entrance to it was the family secret of one of the local Arab families who would take selected tourists there and let them go down the shaft and into the chamber. But it was also thoroughly studied and excavated by Giambattista Caviglia in 1817, the man who excavated the front of the Sphinx. But he kept this secret from Henry Salt, the British consul at the time. It's an interesting story. And I found a lot of stuff of Caviglia's that's never been published before, and it's also in the book. And Salt was a weird character who was severely criticized by a Frenchman called the Count de Forbin in his own book for blocking tunnels and chambers and things which Forbin thought should be explored. So it wasn't just Barrès in 1926 who was a pathological blocker of tunnels and chambers. It was Henry Salt in 1817 who was doing the same thing. This is why Caviglia didn't tell Salt all the times he was out there on his own, which he often was, because he was living in a tent or a cave or whatever it was, just beside the Sphinx, whereas Salt was going back into town to mind the embassy. That he was really secretly also going down this shaft and into this subterranean burial chamber. He never told Salt about it. And he only told Salt about the stuff that was very obvious that you could see in the front. And then among
but how
the other
does one do such a thing to pour cement into antiquity of such importance? It's beyond me.
Well, the world is full of barbarians. Look at the Taliban who blew
up
that giant Buddhist statue.
Yeah, you're right.
There's a lot of crazy people around, and there are more destroyers in the world than there are builders.
Well, so I suppose there was a time when cement was thought of as a wonderful new substance, and that may have been there.
Well, but his intention was to completely seal off this chamber, right?
Yes, it's incredible, isn't
it? How wonderful is that?
On the other hand, just you have to say that the Sphinx has been very seriously over restored now to the point where it's not really the Sphinx anymore, is it?
Yeah. In fact, I live in Rome, and it's the same thing has happened with the Colosseum. It looks like a toy model. It doesn't look like the Colosseum anymore.
If you live long enough, everything is turned into Disneyland.
Yeah, in fact, that's what I've even heard, that they want to create a new Great Pyramid and shut down the old one and reproduce in Disney Pyramid Land.
Reality becomes a copy. This is the curse of civilization. Everything real becomes ersatz and phony, because we have a unique ability as a species to falsify everything.
Yeah.
And to reduce it
to a kind of prestige. I can't call myself an archaeologist, but I'm close. And for people that have this passion in life, it's pretty darn tootin' frustrating.
Well, we're not archaeologists.
I know. I don't know how to give myself a title. I'm an appassionado of everything ancient, and I get myself as best as I can to all of the ancient sites.
Well, there's always something wonderfully lovable about anything old and shabby.
Another thing that I was surprised to see in the book was the picture of the original entrance to the pyramid, the Great Pyramid. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, have you ever been to this point?
Climbing on the outside, you mean?
Uh-huh.
Yes, yes.
Have you been able to get up to that entrance?
Oh, yes, I have, but you can't get in because it's all closed up with iron bars.
Yeah. You can go from the inside, but you can't get out.
I remember being there one night on the outside, and suddenly some ghostly hands appeared from inside and grasped the bars like a convict in a cell. And a man started shouting, "Let me out of here! Let me out of here!" He started to get out of the pyramid.
That was that fellow Mark.
Was it a man or a ghost?
It was a man. He was very fit, and he didn't really mind. He knew he'd gone up a wrong tunnel, but he didn't know that he wouldn't be able to get out when he got to the daylight. So he had to go all the way back down again, backwards.
It was a pretty weird sight.
That's pretty strange. I've heard that there is an additional tunnel inside that leads to that entrance, but I've never been in it. Have you?
Well, he went up it by mistake. It is quite visible when you've been up to the King's Chamber. Well, it's just a little dark passage that you could actually not notice, but
you're not supposed to go in there.
No, you're not.
You have to get special permission, because, you see, that's the way you go down to the subterranean chamber, and nobody's really...
Well, I've been down there.
Have you?
Oh,
have
you?
I haven't. I don't know. That's really brave of you. I sat at the top and watched Robert go down, and it was absolutely just so terrifying, and he kept looking up at me with this very white face like a little moon, saying, "Can you hear me?" And I said, "Yes." "Can you hear me? Can you hear me?" And then
it's
after
pretty
a while,
scary
I
too,
couldn't...
but it's... Sorry.
It's
an amazing journey down there, too.
350
For claustrophobics, it's absolutely not the right path.
Well, good for you for doing it. And then what did you think when you got down there? Did you have to do the crawling bit and then go through?
Yes. That last phase where you crawl in is, to me, very initiatory.
It's hard on the knee.
Yeah. It's just like, how humble do you need to be here?
Yeah.
But the space itself, I managed to be in there for 45 minutes, of which 10 were in the dark. I had some pretty powerful experiences there because I do, I am a psychic, and so I deliberately went there to see what I could get, have come in, which is not subject for this conversation.
No.
Maybe over tea at your house.
Yes.
Well, I can tell you why the ceiling is smooth and the floor is rough down there.
Okay.
Yeah, tell her that.
The strange thing about the subterranean chamber is that it has a very carefully leveled and smooth ceiling, an incredibly rough floor that you can easily trip on. And the reason for that is that in ancient Egyptian tradition, the dead are upside down. So it symbolized the netherworld, where, of course, the dead would walk on the ceiling.
Wow, that's pretty out there.
But that's the truth.
What did you experience down there when you were in there, Robert?
Well, I talk about this a lot more in Egyptian Dawn because the Sphinx mystery, as you know, is entirely about the Sphinx. But I have a lot to say about the pyramids in the book that's coming next. And I have a lot of interesting ideas about the subterranean chamber. This one about the ceiling being where the dead would walk upside down is actually mentioned in the Sphinx mystery because the last two chapters of that book deal with the unbelievably weird mythology of the Egyptians and their religious beliefs relating to what happens after death, which is pretty hair-raising stuff. And it relates directly, you see, to the Sphinx, which is why it's in the Sphinx mystery, but I come back to it again in the pyramid stuff. And the subterranean chamber, I'm certain, was not, as many people imagine, meant to be the original burial chamber. There's nothing of the kind.
No.
And a lot of Egyptologists have suggested that the Egyptians got it wrong. They thought they'd put the burial chamber down there. Then they changed their mind. If the Egyptians would ever change their mind and such a thing. And then they built the king's chamber way up above. And but having built the queen's chamber in between, in other words, they couldn't make up their minds, so they built three different burial chambers, none of which they ever used. The whole thing is complete nonsense. And whatever was going on, and whatever what they were doing with the pyramid was nothing to do with what most Egyptologists imagine, which is just all they can think of is stick a dead king in there, and it's got to be a tomb. It shows how lacking in imagination they are.
Yeah, or sometimes I think that they know the real story and just conceal it, because we know, what was it, years ago, I think 2000, they were supposed to be cleaning up the pyramid for a year.
Mm.
And I went in on my own, I went alone inside the king's chamber for an hour, and it didn't look clean to me. So I think they know a lot more than... especially now, it seems like they're just breaking through to God knows what tunnels and what they're discovering.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. And the fact that they shut the pyramid for a whole year like that is very odd.
Yeah.
It doesn't take that
very
long to
for cleaning
sandblast the graffiti off the walls, and you don't need to close it for a year. So whatever is going on is going on, and you can be sure we don't know what it is.
Yeah, and I think it might very well be related to the fact that, of course, this is conjecture, that they're doing everything they can to build a wall around the whole Giza Plateau, as if they've discovered something so important that they eventually want people completely out of the area. I have a fear that they're going to close it pretty soon.
I think that they're basically sealing off Giza as a first step towards making it impossible for anyone to get in.
Yeah, and for those of you who are listening, that means get to Egypt as soon as possible, because it's an unbelievable experience to be in these places. And I keep telling people, you know, it's happening in Mexico, Peru. They're trying to shut down Machu Picchu, and that doesn't make sense because it brings money into the country. So what is behind this? Subject for another interview for sure, Robert, if you guys will come back.
You bet. We'd love to.
That would be great.
We're almost out of time, and we've just not even scratch the surface. Can you leave us with an imprint that you really want to get out to people? That and then when we close, we will again refer them to your site and the book, which they've got to get.
Well, I want to stress that the Sphinx and the three main pyramids at Giza were part of a unified design concept, which is explained in the book. They were all designed and planned at the same time. The three pyramids were not built as tombs for kings. These four structures, the three pyramids and the Sphinx, were there for a reason, and the two temples in front of the Sphinx. We don't know exactly what the reason was, but it was certainly connected with death and resurrection, the resurrection cult of Egypt, and going beyond this world into the next. And only by recognizing that those four key monuments were part of a unified design concept can we even begin to try to understand the reason for it.
Indeed, and I would like to tell people as well that you go into great lengths regarding the sacred geometry that is used there, and
that's
the
right.
The triangular. I did read. You can be proud of me. I've really read a substantial part of it so far. But this is very important, the triangle being, of course, one of the most important symbols we've got.
Yes,
the beginning of geometry
angle,
starts with the triangle.
The golden angle of 26 degrees plus. I won't give the exact value on your program, but is the basis for the whole of ancient Egyptian art and sacred architecture, and the previously unrevealed pattern linking the four structures is based upon sighting lines between key points of all the structures, all at the same angle. That's the golden angle, which is the angle, the acute angle you get in a triangle formed by means of the golden section. And they were obsessed
mm-hmm.
by the golden section because they believed that it was the key to the structure of the universe, and their religion was based upon worshipping the structure of the universe, cosmic order, which they called by the name of Ma'at, M-A-A-T.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was all about. All the gods were just aspects of Ma'at. And they were probably the most extreme monotheists who ever existed, because they worshipped not an old man in a white beard, but they worshipped cosmic order personified and exemplified in the world. That was the basis of their civilization, the reason for its stability and continuation over thousands of years. And of course, we have no cosmic order in our civilization, which is why it's collapsing.
And we also believe...
Right, indeed. And I have to, unfortunately, start to close with the show, but I would like to leave people with this thought, that it's very possible that why, as we approach 2012 with all of our expectations of this hour in humankind, we seem to be reaching into these civilizations like Egypt, like the Mayans, trying to get back that wisdom of the cosmic order. As we very possibly become galactic beings. And with that, I can only tell you that that opens a whole bunch of kettle of worms, and surely Robert and Olivia have done that with this amazing book. It's a kettle of, maybe not worms, maybe of stardust, and it's exciting. It's revolutionary, just like his other books are, and you're going to want to read this book. So, Olivia, please give us the website again.
It's www.sphinxmystery.info.
Okay, read the book, get to the website, expand your mind, and Anubis. Makes sense. It makes sense, but my heart is still with the lioness because I'm an old Sekhmet worshiper. So next time you come on, we will go deeper, okay?
Well, we like Sekhmet.
Apparently
that's another
subject, but apparently the chapel, Sekhmet Chapel, is also closed at the moment.
Yes, it is. I've just been there. Everything's closed. Very interesting.
Oh,
the Sekhmet Chapel is supposedly there doing archaeological work. My opinion, and this is, of course, also conjecture, is that they don't want people activating these sites.
Yeah, I run into it
in Mexico. I run it in Mexico, for example, at Chichen Itza. When I went there, they locals told me that George Bush had come, and he went up to the top of the temple at Chichen Itza with Vicente Fox, and they came down, and then they closed the pyramid. So something's going on, and we're going to dig into it every time we can on Beyond the Matrix with Patricia Corey. We have to go. I hope you have really told your friends about this interview, and please know that it is re-airing on Saturday, 10 o'clock, California time, so if anybody missed it, tell your friends to tune in to Beyond the Matrix, bbsradio.com. They'll be spending an hour, very valid and very important. Thank you, my beloved guests, and I will welcome the moment when we meet in person.
Thanks very much.
Thank certainly you, have in spirit.
It's been great to talk to you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much. Okay, everybody, we're signing out now. Please know that next week I've got Tom Carey. He's a co-author of the book Witness to Roswell. Oh, yes, this is subject matter for Beyond the Matrix. Thank you all. I'll talk to you next week. And don't forget, you can start tuning in now on Saturdays at 10, Cal time. Arrivederci.